Inside Florida Politics. The Essential Podcast powered by Gatehouse Florida. I'm Palm Beach Post staff writer George Bennett, back in the friendly confines of our studio in West Palm Beach, Florida. I'm joined, as always, from Tallahassee by the Gatehouse State Capitol Bureau Chief, John Kennedy.
Good morning.
And the Sarasota Herald Tribune politics editor, Zach Anderson.
Hey, George.
And that's already a pretty raging inferno of podcasting talent, but we're going to pour some rocket fuel on it today because we have a special guest. Palm Beach Post staff writer Wayne Washington is joining us. Welcome, Wayne.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Ooh, and we are queuing up the guest music that sounds a little bit like Dick Dale's Miserloo, but it's not, to welcome our guest, Wayne Washington. Well, we got a loaded lineup for you. You know, this was supposed to be the special post-election hindsight edition of the podcast, but since this is Florida, of course, there's some major elections that are not yet over. It looks like the U.S. Senate race between three-term Democratic Senator Bill Nelson and his Republican challenger, Governor Rick Scott, is heading for a recount. There's also a chance that the governor's race will trigger a recount. Right now, Ron DeSantis, the Republican, is up by a little more than 0.5% over Democrat Andrew Gillum as we record this on Thursday morning, less than 2 days after the polls closed. If that margin gets below 0.5%, then there would be an automatic recount in that race. The much-watched Ag Commissioner's race is definitely heading for a recount. We also got potential recounts in some legislative races. So for starters, John Kennedy in Tallahassee, give us a little briefing on what the recount situation is and how recounts are conducted in Florida.
Well, today, as we speak, it's 2 days after the election, so things are really an evolving story right now. But the Florida's race for the U.S. Senate looks at it like it's bound for a recount, with Republican Governor Rick Scott holding a very wafer-thin lead over Democrat Bill Nelson. It's within the 0.5% margin that forces a recount. The race for agriculture commissioner between Democrat Nikki Fried and Republican Matt Caldwell is even tighter. Caldwell was holding about a 8,000 vote lead. And like the Senate, this is, well after 8 million votes have been cast. So it's a very narrow margin of victory for anybody right now. There are recounts also expected in a state Senate race where it's one where the Democrats may have their only chance to pick up a seat. Their Tampa Democrat Janet Cruz is narrowly ahead of Republican incumbent State Senator Dana Young. And there's probably a couple of recounts coming in state House races as well. Just on that point, the recounts really don't look like they'll be declared until Saturday, which is the deadline for the county canvassing boards to submit what are considered unofficial returns to the Secretary of State, Ken Detzner. Now Detzner is a Scott appointee, but he is also the guy who is he looks at the numbers and officially calls for a recount under Florida law. A machine recount will come first, with all the optical scan ballots fed through the tabulating machines again, and so-called overvotes and undervotes are set aside. Those are the ballots where voters filled in too many blanks or not enough names. If the recount yields a less than 0.25% difference between the candidates, then a manual recount is done on all these overvotes and undervotes, and the local canvassing boards call in counting teams to attempt to determine the will of the voter. We all remember it's somewhat reminiscent of the magnifying glass scene so vivid in the 2000 presidential recount.
Right. That's where it gets interesting. And potentially you got, lawyers arguing over individual ballots. So a machine recount means they just feed the ballots through the scanners again. So presumably it's not going to it shouldn't alter that many votes in the total.
Right.
But then when you pull out those undervotes, and now an overvote, somebody votes for two candidates in a race, the ballot is disqualified. But the undervotes are the ones that are interesting. And so, for example, on an optical scan ballot, if you're instructed to fill in the oval, out of 8 million voters, there's going to be some people that don't follow the instructions. So if a person, instead of filling in the oval, decided to circle the candidate's name, when that gets fed into a scanner, the scanner doesn't see a mark in the oval and counts it as an overvote. If you get to a really close race where they pull out those ballots, then you get the possibility of seeing something like that. Now, in a case like that, that would be, you know, probably a clear indication of the voter preferring a particular candidate. But as we know from 2000, you know, the technology has changed, but there is never underestimate the ability of candidates and their lawyers to argue over these ballots and whether what a voter was trying to do. So those ones that get within 0.25, and it's a very good chance that the Scott Nelson race will be in that, and certainly the Ag Commissioner race is, those are the ones where it's going to get really interesting.
Yeah, and really, it's the recount process is going to take a while, you know, first to determine it and then to conduct it. And the official certification of the elections is to take place on November 20th when the State Elections Canvassing Commission meets. So we may have plenty of action until then.
Right. So the next big deadline, though, we're recording this on Thursday, and I know there's a lot of podcast listeners that eagerly await as soon as the new episode drops and they're listening to it. But one of the key dates to watch will be, what is it, Saturday at noon. That's when the Secretary of State will determine which races are going to go to a recount. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, that's when the unofficial returns are due back from the counties. And that presumably would be the trigger for Secretary of State Detzner to take some action on these potential recount races.
Now, are either you guys familiar with the situation in Broward County with the ballot design there?
Yeah, I've seen it and I've read a little bit about the controversy about it. I think we're going to hear more about it today as well from Nelson's attorneys. Nelson is already lawyering up for this. It's something where it looks like that ballot had the Senate race kind of segregated from the other races. It had it at the bottom of a column of what appeared to be mostly instructions to the voters. So there's anecdotal talk from some candidates, at least according to news reports, that, you know, some voters failed to vote in the Nelson race. So at this point, though, I don't know what happens with that. You can condemn the poor design of the ballot, but that's not going to result in any kind of do-over for Nelson.
It's not like they left it off there. It's clearly visible. I mean, poor ballot design doesn't seem like something where you go back and you know, submit new votes or something like that.
Right. I mean, the infamous butterfly ballot in Palm Beach County, ultimately, that was not, you know, there was no, when people marked, you know, two votes or something because of that ballot, none of those were, you know, were able to be counted. I mean, it got a lot of attention, but, you know, if somebody doesn't mark the ballot, it's pretty hard to argue for a vote to be included or a vote for a particular candidate. Well, so it's going to be, so this is Florida, so it's going to be interesting overtime for the midterm election. We'll be discussing a little more of that, but I think right now I hear the sound of some funky royalty-free music playing. And listeners to the podcast know when you hear that music, it means it's time for our Pick a Number segment. That's where each of us are going to put forward a number, and later in the podcast, we will explain what that number means in Florida politics. So let me reach out first to Sarasota, Zach Anderson. Do you have a number for us today?
I'm going to go with 11 today.
Okay, 11. Spinal Tap reference for Zach Anderson in Sarasota. John Kennedy, what's your number today?
George, I have a 24.
Okay, John Kennedy with a 24. My number today is going to be the number 4, which I think was my number last week, but it's in a different context. And our special guest, Wayne Washington, joining us. Wayne, tell us what number you have brought for us today.
I'm going to go with the number 9.
Number 9. So once again, and we always do encourage our listeners to take notes throughout the podcast, really, as long as you're not driving a car or operating heavy machinery, to review those numbers. We'll go lowest to highest. George Bennett, that's me. I had the number 4. Wayne Washington, my colleague from the Palm Beach Post and our special guest today, has the number 9. Zach Anderson, Spinal Tap fan with a number 11. Ours go to 11 over in Sarasota. And John Kennedy with the number 24, always the curve buster, John Kennedy with the high number. So you're going to want to stay till the end of the podcast and find out what those numbers mean in Florida politics. But let's get back to our loaded lineup today. So one thing I just wanted to throw out there now, you know, we got these recounts. We don't know what's going to happen. But there's a very real possibility if Bill Nelson loses And if the ag commissioner's race continues, it's very tight. But if the Republican Matt Caldwell holds on to win and these other results hold, it's very possible that you will not have a single statewide elected Democrat in Florida next year. I don't believe, maybe I didn't look back in the history books, maybe in the Reconstruction era after the Civil War might have been the only other time that there has never been a statewide Democrat. John Kennedy, you're a grizzled veteran of Tallahassee. Has there been another time without a Democrat in statewide office in Florida?
Now, to the best of our knowledge right now, it appears, looking back very briefly at history, that Democrats dominated Florida for that whole period post-Reconstruction, you know, which ended in the late 1880s. And it wasn't until Republicans took over state government in the mid-90s that you really had mid to late 90s, where you had Republicans at command. But throughout that period, the Democrats always had at least somebody that was a statewide office holder. Nelson, if he is knocked down, he's been the last one. He's been in the United States Senate since 2000, and he was a cabinet member for 6 years before that. So Nelson has been kind of the standard bearer, and it really leaves the Democratic Party kind of adrift in Florida.
Yeah, no, I tried to do some research, and the 19th century podcasts were really unreliable, so I wasn't sure about back then. But so here's the question I had. Let's in that scenario, if Bill Nelson is knocked out, and if Nikki Fried doesn't make it to Ag Commissioner, let me ask each of you guys who would be the face of the Florida Democratic Party be then at that point? Zach, you got any thoughts on that?
You know, the Democrats are the one of the few bright spots that they had this election. And really, it looks like it's going to be a low point in a party that has seen a lot of low points. I mean, this could be a pretty ugly election for them if they lose their only statewide elected official. We'll see what happens with the recounts here. But the bright spot that they had was they picked up two congressional seats, and they picked up some seats in the state legislature, not enough to make a difference and have any real power. But at the congressional level, it is interesting because Republicans now have 14 seats to 13 for Democrats. So it's almost even, which, you know, kind of reflects the partisan divide of the state. And a lot of that was because of, the Fair Districts Amendment and the fact that the Supreme Court made them go back and redraw those congressional districts. But, you know, you'd have to probably say that the face of the party right now is at the congressional level, which not a lot of people know who most of those folks are. Maybe somebody like Charlie Crist, who used to be governor, kind of steps forward here, but they really don't have a face of the party.
Okay. So yeah, really not. Maybe the 13-member Democratic Congressional Caucus is what you're putting forward there. John Kennedy, any idea who's the face of the Democratic Party in a post-Nelson world?
Yeah, it's really they have no statewide candidates, no clear leadership, and no real opportunity to build a bench, which would have been easy with the election of Andrew Gillum as governor. Now, Gillum, in his concession speech the other night, though, on election night, he said the quote was, "I'm not going anywhere. We're going to fight and we're going to keep fighting. We're going to keep working." So that maybe suggests he could step into this vacuum in some way and play a role as party leader. But the party is, you know, really hurting with this election loss, especially after aspirations were so high and the results are so close.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think Gillum is probably the party's best bet. Florida has this reputation of being a purple state. But I think we're finding out that the only purple that exists are the bruising that the Republicans put on the Democrats every time there's a statewide election. This is really not so much a purple state as it is a pretty solid red state. And Gillum probably is the party's best, the Democratic Party's best opportunity to have a face. If they're going to have a face, it probably is going to be Gillum.
Yeah, I would, I tend to agree with that. Plus, he's, you know, physically located in Tallahassee, which is, you know, kind of near the levers of state government. So, assuming these races turn out the way they look right now, Gillum is probably as good a bet as any to be a face for the party. It'd be a huge generational shift. I mean, he's 39. Bill Nelson, who has been the face of Florida Democrats, is, I believe, 76 years old. But just something interesting to ponder. The other thing is, though, I mean, I guarantee you in 2020, Florida is going to be a battleground in the presidential race. I mean, Republicans have won all these offices, but they, as we're seeing right now, I mean, they have been very close races. And, you know, the last couple presidential races have been very close. So, you know, I'm sure that the Democrats are not going to give Republicans a pass on the 2020 presidential race. But it is an interesting period in Florida's political history.
Sticking on the face of the party just briefly, I mean, if Nikki Fried, who has the best chance probably of maybe claiming a seat here with, you know, only 4,000 votes down, and who knows where it'll end up going into Saturday, that would be a really interesting face of the party for Democrats. A younger woman who is very pro marijuana, you know, also sort of a generational shift. So we'll have to see what happens with that.
That could be it. So let's move on to, and we're going to talk about the governor's race in a little bit, but one of the reasons we brought Wayne Washington with us to the podcast today is to talk about congressional races in the state. Now, nationwide, I believe Democrats gained 30 plus or minus seats and took control of the U.S. House of Representatives. In Florida, there were two seats that ended up switching hands, both went from Republican to Democrat, both in the Miami area. But Wayne covered another race. This was kind of the second tier of competitive races. And if there had been a real tsunami in Florida, this would have been a much more in-play race. But tell us a little bit about the Congressional District 18 race, Brian Mast, Republican freshman, and he was challenged by Democrat Lauren Baer.
Right. This was a race that when we first learned who the candidates would be, of course, we first learned who Lauren Baer is, it seemed that the race could be more competitive than it ultimately turned out to be. This is a district. District 18 includes northern Palm Beach County and all of Martin and St. Lucie counties. And, you know, the district has been represented by both Democrats and Republicans in recent years. And so there'd been some thought that it would actually be truly competitive. And the Democrats fielded a pretty strong candidate, Lauren Baer. That last name is familiar. It's because her relatives own and operate Baer Furniture. And she grew up in the district. She's a Harvard law grad, served in the Obama administration as a policy advisor in the U.S. State Department under two secretaries of state. And so she was attempting to become, I believe, the first married gay woman in college. She's married to a woman and has a child. And she ran, you know, a strong race. She ran on health care. Brian Mast, a U.S. Army veteran who lost both of his lower legs during an explosion in Afghanistan, ran on the toxic algae. And it looks like algae trumped health care and Mast took it.
Yeah. And what was his percent, around 54 or
so? He was at 54.
Okay. Yeah.
He was at 54.
But that's an example of a race that, you know, in a big wave, it's an example. The fact that the Republicans held on to that, it shows, you know, the limits of the blue wave, at least in Florida. And what's interesting about that district is, as Wayne mentioned, the environmental issue mm-hmm. was big there. And in fact, Baer criticized Mast for being too focused on a single issue.
Right. She said, you know, we can't afford a single issue congressman. This isn't a single issue district. And certainly there are lots of folks who are unhappy with health care. Brian Mast voted earlier in his term, along with his Republican colleagues, to repeal Obamacare. And then there were subsequently some town hall meetings and people got after Mast. You know, lots of folks showed up and let him have it, but he stuck to that vote. And Baer was not quite able to make as much hay as perhaps she thought she might.
I'll tell you one thing that'll be interesting to watch is the other kind of the one area where Mast really stepped aside from most Republicans was he called for an assault weapons ban. And in fact, when he did that, it drew him a couple of challengers in a Republican primary. He ended up defeating him, but there was definitely some bad feelings among some Republicans over that. So I'm wondering now, with Democrats in control of Congress, if Mast, you know, if there is some kind of assault weapons ban, if Mast would cross the aisle on something like that. I know some of the ones that have been proposed he thought went too far on restricting other types of guns, but What's your thought on that, Wayne?
Well, I think he will really be challenged to hold to this recent position because before, when Republicans were in control, he knew well that there would be no legislation that would call for an assault weapons ban. And so saying you're a Republican and staking out ground in favor of an assault weapons ban, you would never really have to be called on to vote for such a ban.
Right.
But now there's the good possibility that he might actually be called on to vote for such a ban. And we could see by just what energy was created on his right when he said he was in favor of an assault weapons ban, what might actually happen if he actually votes for an assault weapons ban. I would imagine there not only would be primary opponents, but possibly lots of money coming at him then, too.
Very, very good possibility of something to watch. Now, one other race, very briefly, Zach Anderson, over your part of the state, there was Vern Buchanan, kind of similar situation to Mast, kind of a borderline seat. What ended up happening in that congressional race?
Yeah, George, you mentioned the limits of the blue wave, and this race showed that as well. This was a seat that Democrats were pretty hopeful about early on in the cycle. They recruited a strong candidate, David Shapiro, a local attorney. He was able to raise just a boatload of money, ended up raising more than $2 million, and got a lot of help from outside groups. Really went after Vern Buchanan hard over his involvement with the big GOP tax cut law. They found out through his financial disclosure that he bought a yacht on the same day that he voted for the tax cut law. And they really tried to hammer him as you know, advancing that law in his own self-interest so that he could give himself a big tax break and buy a yacht. But that attack seemed to fall short. Buchanan ended up winning by 9 percentage points, really a blowout. And it just showed that, Democrats really struggled in GOP-leaning seats. The two congressional seats that they picked up in South Florida were really sort of Democratic seats. These were seats that Hillary Clinton carried by huge margins. They were seats that Democrats should be able to do well in. But when it came to Republican-leaning seats like this Mass seat or this Buchanan seat or other seats in the Tampa Bay area and around the state, Democrats really fell well short, which showed that they didn't have a wave that was anywhere near big enough to lift them up in GOP-leaning areas or even in these statewide races, which are really kind of toss-up races.
Yeah, we'll talk about the governor's race. Now, you mentioned the word yacht, and I think we need to start because a couple of weeks ago we mentioned the word manifesto as one of those words that whenever you hear it in politics, it's not a good thing. Anything when you write something and it gets called a manifesto, it's not good. And anytime in politics that the word yacht comes up with you, it's probably not good. So we need to start maybe a little side project of the kind of the trouble words in politics. Yacht definitely belongs on that list. But let's talk about that governor's race. So as it stands right now, a narrow victory for DeSantis. Right now, outside the margin of a machine recount, it could, depending on how many more ballots they find down in Broward County, it could get within recount territory. But one thing that struck me about that race is if you had told Democrats a couple of years ago that you were going to substantially improve your margin in the blue counties of South Florida, you're going to rack up a much bigger margin there, that you're going to rack up a much bigger margin for the Democrat in Orange and Osceola counties, the kind of emerging Democratic areas in Central Florida. If you'd told Democrats you're going to flip Duval County, a couple other counties that had voted for President Trump 2 years ago, that those were going to become blue counties, you would really like your chances of winning the governorship for the first time in this millennium. But, and all those things, in fact, happen in the governor's race. But what we saw also was Republican turnout really exploded. Zach, over in your part of the state, Southwest Florida, and in these other red counties. And, you know, as of right now, it appears the Republican turnout was enough to counteract a really big increase in Democratic turnout in the areas that they usually focus on. What did you see on that front, Zach, over there in deep red part of Southwest Florida?
Yeah, Trump came to Fort Myers towards the end of this campaign, and he really, obviously they had a strategy there. They wanted to fire up the red areas of the state and just try and run up the margins in those areas, and it appears to have worked. I mean, it is a very narrow lead that the Republicans had at the state level, but it appears like, barring a big reversal in a recount, that it's probably going to hold up. And the Republicans have proven very savvy at finding ways to turn out their voters, even in a year this year when Democrats appeared to be energized. Republicans have gone to the suburban, exurban, rural parts of the state and really worked hard to boost their margins there. Trump really campaigned hard on immigration in the end. And that's an issue that resonates, especially in this part of the state, which has a lot of older white retired voters. So I think that, the Republican turnout effort, Democrats brag a lot about their turnout effort and talk a lot about it, but the Republicans get out there and get their voters, and they've proven that they can really get them to the polls.
I could break in briefly. One thing that's notable is the best county of all in Florida for turnout in this election was Sumter County, which is not widely known, but best known maybe as the home of the Villages. And that's a heavy retiree, very Republican area, always a favorite of Republican candidates. The Sumter County voted about 78%. That's 16% better than the statewide average, which was darn good in itself at 62%.
The last time turnout for a midterm was as high as it was this time was in 1994, which is really before the motor voter law had taken full effect, which kind of made the motor voter law kind of made voter registration easier and brought a lot of more people into as registered voters. A 62% turnout in a midterm is pretty high in Florida or anywhere. One aspect in this race, obviously, was Andrew Gillum was trying to become the first black governor in Florida history. And Wayne Washington did a story recently just about kind of the way that Gillum was approaching going after black voters. And now I know I saw one preliminary exit poll. I don't know how reliable that indicates that the black turnout was probably around 13%, roughly the percent of that blacks are in the overall electorate. But tell us a little bit, Wayne, about kind of the way the Gillum campaign approached going after black voters.
Well, he started without the presumption that being black would earn him black votes automatically. And so he decided early on that he was going to target black voters. He was going to go to their communities, go to their churches, go to various social gatherings where they would be. He would get black voices out there in support for him. He worked really hard to get that done. Of course, black voters are a core part of the Democratic constituency. They are a core of that vote. And he needed nearly universal support, 90-95% support and a high turnout to counteract what is frequently thought of as kind of a ballooning effect, where a Democrat, particularly a black Democrat, would squeeze the balloon for black support and run the risk of losing white support on the other end. And we don't yet know, because we don't know what the exit polling data says, we don't yet know just how much white support he might have leaked out by overtly appealing to black voters. We do know that Trump was very, very effective on behalf of DeSantis in turning out white support, turning out Republican support. And it looks like at this point that Gillum will come up just short. It should be noted that what he was attempting to do was extraordinarily difficult. There have been only two black people elected as governors in the United States history. There have been others who've served, but only two. Douglas Wilder and Deval Patrick in Massachusetts.
Right.
But there have never been any other African-Americans elected as a governor in a state in the United States.
So Florida did vote twice. In fact, you know, other than Bill Nelson and one term of CFO for Alex Sink, the only other Democrat to win a statewide election in Florida in this millennium is Barack Obama, who carried Florida two times. Did you see a significant difference in the way Obama went about things versus Andrew Gillum?
There was a bit of a difference, and the difference really was in tone. One of Gillum's surrogates mentioned to me that Obama was really not free to call out moments when he thought that he was being attacked based on race. But Gillum, because Obama had been successful not once but twice, that Gillum was a little more free to say, hey, look, this is an attack coming at me that's based on race. Now, we don't know if those instances when he mentioned race hurt him among some white voters. There's the possibility that that happened. Mm-hmm. But he was much more open about saying, hey, look, this monkey up comment is based on race. Calling me Andrew repeatedly was a way to diminish his accomplishments. And then, of course, we had a former Georgia official come in and say the race was so, quote, cotton picking important, quote, end quote. And so, you know, the Gillum folks weren't shy about saying, hey, look, we understand that race is a factor, and they're tossing out the dog whistle and going with the bullhorn. Those factors may well have played some small role in his defeat.
Yeah, that'll be. I'll be curious to drill down as more, exit polling data and when the actual hard data comes out on what the actual composition of this electorate was.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see, how that played out, because as you pointed out, I mean, there was one of the viral moments in this campaign was in the debate where DeSantis lost his cool over that question about appearing at the conferences with the guy who had made some racist or racially charged remarks. And Gillum responded, with the line to the effect of, I'm not saying you're racist, yeah, but the people who are racist think you are. And it was a big line. And I think the Gillum campaign even tweeted that clip out. But you wonder overall what, at the end of the day, what effect that right. had.
And it's interesting that that's not a line I think you would ever have heard come from Barack Obama.
Right.
There were many moments during Obama's campaign and during his two terms when African-American voters, supporters were really angry about attacks directed at him and wanted him to identify the attacks as having racism at its core, at their core. But the president would not do that. And there were folks saying, look, don't let them beat you up like this. No one will say that about Gillum. Gillum fought back hard. It's just not sure that the voters wanted him to be their governor.
Right, right. Well, that's something to look at. Now, real quickly, John Kennedy, in the waning moments of this, give us an overview. The Florida legislature has been both the House and Senate controlled by Republicans for two decades. There was a little bit of change in this election. What's the next legislature going to look like in Florida?
Well, it's still going to look very Republican. The Democrats, had high aspirations going into this election, especially in the state Senate. They had six races that they had targeted that they thought they could win in. Right now, they may have won one, and that is subject to a likely recount. So not so hot in the state Senate. Similarly, in the House right now, a little bit better. They have a vast margin. Coming into this election, they are outnumbered in the state House 79-41. And with this election, the Democrats may have they picked up eight Republican seats. They lost one of their own, and a couple are still subject to likely recounts. But the Democrats, a few gains in the House, but they are still going to be in a distant minority in that chamber, and in the Senate, not much better.
Okay, well, thank you for that preview of the upcoming legislative session, John. And right now, though, I think I hear that funky royalty-free music playing again. That means it's time to return to our pick a number segment. And all you note takers, it's time to bring out your notes and find out what each of us were talking about, what those numbers mean in Florida politics. My number is 4. That's the number of votes that Bill Nelson would need in each precinct in Florida to draw even with Rick Scott in the U.S. Senate race. As we record this, Nelson is about 22,000 votes behind Rick Scott. There are 5,881 precincts in Florida. So if Bill Nelson were able to pick up 4 votes in each of those precincts, he would be even with Rick Scott. Our next number was
9.
The number 9, Wayne Washington. Explain that number to us, please.
Well, 9 is the percentage point gap between Brian Mast and Lauren Bair. And, District 18 had been thought of, I thought of it and others thought of it as a potential swing district. But Brian Mast is demonstrating that district is pretty firmly Republican. He won it by 12.5 percentage points the last time around. This time he won it by just under 9. Donald Trump won that district. It's a lean Republican district and was always going to be tough for Lauren Boehr to pick up.
There you go. All right. Our next number was 11. Zach Anderson, explain to us what 11 means.
Yeah, I had to crank this podcast up to 11 to match the intensity of voter turnout in Florida. The voters came out strong. We talked a little bit about how much the turnout had come up. It went up 11 points from 51% in 2014 to 62% in this midterm. As you mentioned earlier, George, it was the highest turnout since 1994. Both sides were really energized, but I think maybe more significant really was the GOP turnout. The president was really able to get his base out in Florida. I think it showed that this state very much remains Trump country for the time being.
Yeah, one and the final numbers won't be available for a few months where you can actually look and see, people who voted. But an estimate from a guy from Associated Industries of Florida, who's usually pretty on with his numbers crunching, the Republicans had a turnout advantage. They were about 40.2% of people who voted, and Democrats were about 38.6%. Is an estimate of what the composition of the electorate was, and then 21 point some were independent voters. Okay, and John Kennedy, last, you had the number 24. What does that mean?
Yeah, we alluded to this a little bit earlier, but it's been 24 years since Florida had as high a voter turnout as the 62% of all registered voters who cast ballots on Tuesday. Just as Tuesday was looking good for Republicans, the 66% of Florida voters who cast ballots in the 1994 election, that year they also went heavily Republican, although they did hand Democratic Governor Lawton Chiles a re-election victory over first-time candidate, a young Republican named Jeb Bush. Bush, as we all know, he'd come back 4 years later and he'd won his first of two terms as governor. 1994, though, was a disastrous year for Democrats nationally. It was Bill Clinton's midterm and Republicans gained both houses of Congress. And it began what you remember, the contract with America.
There you go. Going into the Wayback Machine with John Kennedy there. OK, well, listen, thank you all. It has been my honor to host another Inside Florida Politics podcast. I'm George Bennett from the Palm Beach Post. I've been joined here in our studio by special guest Wayne Washington, another Palm Beach Post staff writer. We've had John Kennedy, the State Capitol Bureau Chief for Gatehouse Media in Tallahassee, and Sarasota Herald Tribune politics editor Zach Anderson. And here in West Palm, we've been helped by Joe Forzano. He's half of the Corzano team. Thomas Cordy couldn't be with us today, but Joe Forzano making it all happen. And of course, the man behind the curtain in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, Adam Fish. Thank you.